And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Have I got a story to tell you? But I will have to save that for another day. Suffice it to say that on this day, as we begin bringing you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true, Mercury is in retrograde. Technology is in retrograde. With what happened with Facebook and all social media, which, of course, Lady Gaga says is the toilet bowl of the internet, and I sort of kind of in a way agree with her, we've been having some fun here on both ends with my guest as well as myself. I want to remind you that we come your way Mondays at 1 a.m., Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., podcasting at richarddugan.com, the homepage, as well as the radio shows page, as well as on SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, TuneIn Radio. Oh my gosh, the list just keeps growing, and we're very excited about it, and we hope that you will go to the podcast and listen to the entire interview. It's going to be awesome, I guarantee you. Today, we're going down the Celtic Road, and we're going to listen to some stories and information, exciting stuff from our special guest today. I bet you she wishes that she was coming to you all the way from Ireland. We're going to talk about legends of the Grail, stories of Celtic goddesses, and heroines of Avalon and other tales. And Kate Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us. And wouldn't it be fun to be doing this interview in Ireland?
Well, if we wait until next week, I could do it in the British Isles.
Well, we'll do this, and then we'll do that, and it'll be just fine. And I will envy you the whole time. It's been a long time since I've been to Ireland, like 2004, and I miss that land so much.
So you have Irish lineage?
I do indeed. Dugan is the last name from my father's side. I just don't know how we got here. Obviously, most likely on a boat. But I love the Celtic legends and history and so forth, and all that it encompasses. The one thing I found so fascinating as we get set to talk about, for example, legends of the Grail, is that of all of the civilizations that have attempted to usurp and circumvent the freedom of the Irish, no one has been successful to this date, not even the British, in spite of the fact that they do hold six counties in the north. And, of course, we're still looking for that wonderful unification, should it come. But really, what we really want more than anything else is peace in that land. But the Norse came there, and different civilizations have come there. They've come and gone. Because the Irish know how to... they have the staying power, apparently. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful country and a beautiful people. You, Sullivan, now is that Irish or Scottish or British?
Well, that's my married name. And it was interesting because when I met my husband, I said, Sullivan, the O'Sullivans, I know your clan. I know that you're from Munster, from southwestern Ireland. I know your people. I know your stories. And so we immediately hit it off. And actually, for our honeymoon, we walked the way of St. Patrick from Belfast down to County Cork.
Oh, wow.
Actually, down to the Bear Peninsula, and we stopped by Cashel, which was the original home of the Gaelic Sullivans, and there is actually a Sullivan Trail of Tears that the British are responsible for.
You ever been to Newgrange?
We had. Wonderful time at Newgrange. Newgrange is really looked after now. It's quite a special place. But if you want to go to Newgrange before it really became a museum, it's sort of Newgrange is like going to Stonehenge. You know, it's now a museum. But you can go to Loch Rue, and there are other places that you can go where you can still just sit quietly by the stones. The Irish are, you're right, they're unstoppable. They're mystical in a way that's unfathomable. They're mystical and magical and everywhere.
Yeah. Don't mess with them, please.
Well, when I collected the folklore for these books, I collected the ones in Legends of the Grail are actually mostly Irish, and the ones in Heroines of Avalon are mostly British. And there was a certain point that I was like, they really need to be two separate books. They're both wonderful, but for different reasons. Yes.
Well, it's exciting to talk about. And I'm thrilled to have you on the program and to have the opportunity to talk to you about the work that you're doing. I will tell you that a gentleman I met who is has his doctorate in mythology. He was actually on a program on this station with another host talking about the Holy Grail. And we got to talking about that a little bit afterwards. And the next thing you know, he and I are co-hosting a program, part of this program, Tell Me Your Story, called Mythosophia, exploring the depths of myth and wisdom. And we did 12 parts, for one for each month. And then we got to talking, and I didn't even realize how many other areas mythology exists. I hadn't even thought about it in the context of war. Sports, of course, we talked about the mythology in sports and science fiction and video games and obviously philosophies, religions, and so forth. It's just, that's what it's all about, is stories, isn't it? I read something along the lines of, Kipling, I think it was, who said something along the lines of that if history were taught in stories, we'd remember it.
Well, that's interesting, because if you look back in time to the tradition of the bards, they were the poets of the time, and of course they still exist in Ireland and in Britain, and the bards had to learn 250 stories of their people, and there was a reason behind it, because if you knew the 250 stories of your people, then you continued to hold the light even during the darkest of times, even when the world seemed a little chaotic or when the weather was getting a little strange. You had the 250 stories of your people and you could keep going. And there are many, many stories of the Grail. I mean, if you did a 12-part series, you probably know.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yes.
Now, I just happened to open the Legends of the Grail, Stories of the Goddess, to one page in particular, one of the chapters. Now, oh, there it is. This is, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, if I'm reading it correctly, Bridget in Myth and Legend, Goddess of Poetry and Healing.
Yes.
I had an experience in Ireland when my wife and I were there in 2004. We were staying on the west coast of in Galway, in Connemara, and we took a ferry out to the Aran Islands to Inishmore. And we were walking through the cemetery, I guess, or the graveyard of the seven churches. Now, to preface this, the night before I'd had a dream, but it was audible. And all I remember hearing, and this was from a dear friend of mine who passed away in our home. He would have been on the trip with us had he not passed. And all I heard was, "Don't you say anything bad in front of Bridget." So there we are in the seven churches, and I'm kind of looking around, and I found this altar with these stones and what looked like the first wheel, and I took a picture of it, and I was kind of joking around about it. My wife walks up to me. She says, "You need to come here." Another preface: my wife's last name is McDonough.
Ah, well, so, there you go.
So we're walking. So we're walking across the cemetery, and she says, Look at the tombstone. Now, this was a flat tombstone. And the name on the tombstone was, you guessed it, Bridget McDonough.
Oh, my goodness.
I immediately put my hand over my mouth and walked away.
You didn't talk to her.
Didn't say a word, because I didn't want to risk it.
Right.
The mystical aspect. Let's go ahead and talk about the Grail. Now, I have heard many stories, especially, for example, from Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, where he, in the fiction, theorizes that the Holy Grail is shown in the picture of the Last Supper. And again, there are so many different myths, so many different theories.
Yeah.
What is yours?
Well, you know, when I was given my overseas research award and went and wandered through Ireland, I wasn't looking for the Grail. I was looking for folklore. And what I ran across were a lot of interesting stories, Bridget being one of them. of these really empowered, fantastic superheroines that existed in the Celtic lands. And I had been looking for some sort of, for the stories of the feminine. Yeah, I've been reading the Arthurian legends, I've been reading all these other things. And I really wanted to find out if there was a reason, if I had some kind of lineage, powerful feminine lineage, and I found it there. Now, the thing is, in Ireland, like you said, you go to these places and you have to be able to open up to the mystical self. I mean, if you're mystical anyway and you go to Ireland, it's just going to blow open for you. And I think even if you're not mystical, it might blow open anyway. So what I was starting to experience there was the fact that the land itself had stories contained in it. They're recorded into the land. And that if you sat quietly and really listened, these stories would come to you. So the bards still living in the spirit world, bards still living in physical world, rambling houses and so forth. But that's what I was looking for. It was later when I was working on Heroines of Avalon, when I was in Britain, that I was really studying Grail legend and realized there was a deep connection between the ancient Irish Grail cauldron cup of Dagda legends and what was going on in Arthurian legend. But since my quest was for the feminine, the stories of the feminine, then I just call these stories the Grail. So if you take Arthurian legend and you go on a crusade, you know, traditionally you go on a crusade, you go on the hero's quest to the Middle East, and it might be that you're looking for Joseph of Arimathea and the Cup of Christ. It might be that you're looking for Mary Magdalene or Sophia. And I took really sort of following Sophia. It's interesting that you were talking about Sophia. Where is the Shekinah, and does the Shekinah intermingle with the Celtic tradition? And so what I found on my heroine's journey was that, yes, in these sacred springs and in these sacred wells, if you sit quietly and become very receptive, then what the Grail actually is starts to come to you. And of course, in my mind, what the Grail is, it's your wholeness. It's when you've gone on your quest and you've found your love and your compassion and your strength and your power. You've confronted your dragons. You found your companions, your mystical companions and your earthly companions. And you realize, yes, this inner spark, my inner Grail, that I'm eternal. I walk forever.
I love the fact that you have a master's in spiritual psychology.
Yes.
That has to be very interesting, not only when looking back at our past in different cultures, but even in this day and age, because there's a big difference between spiritualism, if you will, spirituality, and religion, doctrine, dogma, philosophy, if you will. Is your perspective that spirituality, or in this case, is something that's lived? It's the way in which you live, and not necessarily by a set of rules, but by, say, one's conscience and or intuition, that kind of thing?
Well, absolutely. If you think for a second about going on your Grail quest, your hero heroine's journey, it's not something you might be able to do it in the context of a Christian or Jewish or some sort of or Wiccan even tradition. You might be able to do that, but what you're really doing is that you're making your own direct connection to the divine, whatever that means for you. And those faces might change as you're journeying. So if you're in Ireland and you're meeting guides and so forth, what you probably meet are the gods, the Tuatha De Dunan, which are the ancient beings of that land. If you're questing through Wales, you might very well meet Arinrud and Blued Eye with and Taliesin and some of these other characters. So they're the different landscapes are going to hold different stories. If you're around Glastonbury, then you'll be more in the Grail quest to find King Arthur and maybe the early Jesus. So depending on what you're looking for, you're going to have different stories etched into the land. And in terms of my own particular belief system, I guess you could call me an old Gnostic. I'm definitely into making a direct connection with the living intelligence.
Well, I'm certainly not gonna refer to you as old. I'll tell you that right now. you're anything but that. But what I you mentioned one name that came up that you just mentioned is you said Taliesin.
Oh yes.
Okay. I need you to give me some information about that because there is a place in the U.S. that is referred to as Taliesin. What is
Taliesin is an old bard. Some people would also call him Merlin.
Ooh.
So the book I'm working on right now, which you probably enjoy, is called Kings and Heroes. So we're getting more into the masculine archetypes. And my guide through this book has been Taliesin. So he's one of the ancient bards. So he's got a fun story. So in the Welsh tradition, and there's a woman named Cerwydyn. And Cerwydyn had two children. One was very beautiful and one was very ugly. So she wanted to give her son a beautiful gift so that even though he might be ugly, he would be the wisest person in the world. And I love Cerwydyn. She's usually seen as, I don't know if she's really a witch, but she's sort of portrayed that way. She's usually got her legs wrapped around a cauldron and steam rising up. And she usually wears a red dress and she's got long white hair. And so she's stirring her cauldron. She's stirring this cauldron, stirring this cauldron. But in order for this spell to work that she's creating to give one person all the wisdom of the world, it has to be stirred for a year and a day. So she gets tired of this and she calls this kid in. And so he starts stirring the pot and stirring the pot. And she says, "Don't you dare touch this because this wisdom, the wisdom of the world, goes to my son, Agadfu, I think his name is." And so anyway, he's very diligent. He stirs and he stirs and he stirs and the steam rises and he's very interested in this, but he's behaving himself. And at the end of the year and the day, the water is bubbling so much that it bubbles out and a hot drop falls into his thumb. And he puts his finger in his mouth and he sucks it. And guess what? All the wisdom of the world passes to Taliesin. He's now known as Taliesin. And Cerwydyn is furious. She can't believe this has happened. So she charges after him. And because he now has all the wisdom of the world, he can shapeshift. And so he becomes a rabbit and she turns into a wolf and they run. And right before she gets him, then he turns into an owl, but then she turns into a hawk. And on it goes. There were fish and all sorts of things until finally he turns himself into a little grain of wheat. And then she eats him. She turns herself into a hen and she eats him. At which point she's impregnated by this child. And he grows within her. He comes out and he is known as the great bard of the British Isles, Taliesin. And as I said, some people call him Merlin, but he's the guide. If you really want to go find some great stories, you know, he's the one to track on Sarn Helen or some of these ancient roads that you can walk in these trees. Yes. And listen to the way the wind blows through the leaves and say, "Oh, I think I hear him. I think I hear him now. His voices are blowing to me from the sea."
Wow. We are talking with Anne Kate Sullivan, and we are talking about the legends of the Grail as stories of Celtic goddesses as well as heroines of Avalon and other tales. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay where you are.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Hey, welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, along with my very special guest, Anne Kate Sullivan, and we're talking about the work that she's doing and has been doing for quite some time. She is, or has, I should say, she has an MA, an MFA, a PhD, an LBQ, a GQW. I don't know what the others are. But anyway, she's also an award winner as well as a best-selling author. She holds, as I mentioned, a master's degree in spiritual psychology from USM and a master's and doctorate in literature from Columbia University and King's College, in London. Very nice. We were in Kildare on February 2nd, 2014, my wife's birthday, and she wanted to go to Bridget's Well. So we did. And
yes.
I started taking pictures, both of the well and of the statuary and all the good stuff around there. And when I got home, when we got back home to Phoenix, put them up on the computer, and I was looking at the pictures of the well. Now, it was obviously winter, February being winter, and certainly there were leaves about. But there was this one image inside the well at water level that we could not identify, and it didn't look anything like a leaf. Mm. My wife said it was a fairy.
Well, quite possibly.
there are legends throughout Ireland and in the Celtic traditions of tree circles, which is I think, if I'm remembering correctly, is that not where the fairies usually mingle and carry on and so forth, where they even live for that matter?
Well, there's an old Irish tradition of the Om. It's a sacred language of the trees, and you might have seen it. They look like runes. You'll see them hanging in different places. Mm-hmm. And so each tree, like for instance, a birch tree will have a mark, a one. So it's an entrance tree. And so there are 20 of these sacred trees. And when you get the traditional one is the oak tree, and Bridget is the guardian of the oaks. So when you get a gathering of five oak trees, it's called usually called a nematona, but it's known as a portal to the fairy realms or the other worlds. And the shaman, the Celtic shaman, or the druids, the ovates there, would practice traveling through the trees, through the oak, and meeting up with the fairy folk. Now, and here we seem to think that it's something for children, but in Ireland, the encounters with the fairies are quite real. You said you had an encounter with fairy folk, yes?
Well, it was especially at Bridget's Well. In Kildare that we saw the fairies, but not until after I was able to put the pictures up on the computer. And the irony was that the pictures that I took the first year we were there, 2002-03, which I say it that way because we flew over on the 23rd of December and flew home after New Year's. So we were there for 2 years, so to speak. I used a regular film camera, and I had to brighten every single one of those images up in Photoshop, whereas I took digital pictures the second time around. I didn't have to touch any of them up, and they were just incredible, some of the imagery that we got. But my wife would stand in certain places. We were, I want to say it was around, Blarney Castle. And there was this one giant tree. And my wife is all dressed in black, this beautiful black coat and so forth. And I get a profile of her from head to toe facing the tree. I mean, it's just the most, and it's her head is up. I mean, she's smiling as if to say to the tree, hello, it's great to see you. And, she's very, very in touch with the natural world.
Sounds lovely.
And I have developed that because, I mean, I grew up in the city. I grew up in Phoenix. What do I know? What do I know about the forest?
You have Irish blood. That's why you can't help yourself.
Well, the real irony was I took an aptitude test when I was 19, hoping that I would have the aptitude for some technical skills. I had the aptitude, according to this test, I had the aptitude for a farmer. Well, I am not far off. I've got chickens and dogs and cats and so on and so forth. But it's fascinating. We mentioned, of course, Newgrange, and you mentioned one other place as well. And then, of course, these different fairy circles, the trees, and then they look like ruins and so on and so forth. There are a lot of what one would call sacred spaces throughout Ireland, aren't there?
Oh, there really are. And if it's your first visit to Ireland, one of the best places to go is Kildare. It's just south of Dublin, so it's pretty easy to get to. Mm-hmm. And what's really lovely, I'm thinking of the year, I think it's 2015 when St. Bridget's flame was relit. And what was interesting, there's a tradition of the Celtic Church there where there's a blend of the Celtic traditions, which are pre-Christian, and then the Christian traditions where they come together. A lot of St. Patrick's monks wrote down a lot of the Celtic stories. That's why we still have them. But in Kildare, the flame was relit. Now, I can't remember when it was put out, but I think it was one of the Roman soldiers put out St. Bridget's flame, and it had been held secretly in secret, you know, secret female societies. But in 2015, it was relit publicly, and now also in Glastonbury, you can go and walk with either the goddess or the saint, Bridget, and you can go. Now, she's an interesting character because she's someone that's ancient. She's an ancient springtime goddess. She's an ancient goddess of sovereignty. And so she would be one of the ones that would be able to give the king his kingdom role, his hero or kingship. So she's a very powerful feminine, the feminine face of the divine, but she's the young maiden mother. But in the winter months, you have the other one who if you head towards the Blarney Stone, but then continue south to the Isle of Bear, then you find this old stone dedicated to the Caillach. Did you ever meet her?
Did not, no. No.
She's wonderful too. She's known as the old woman of the world, and sometimes they call her the one-eyed hag. You know, some people, but some people are terrified of her. But what she is like, Kerwidden, the story I just told of the woman with her legs around the pot that stirs. She's the one that holds the wisdom of the ages. And so, what's so lovely about a character like the Caillach is that she holds everything: the good, the bad, the ugly, the young, the old, the sick, the dead, you know, all of it. And so during say Samhain in that tradition where, which is Halloween here, when the veils are very thin, you would crawl into her cairn and listen to the dreams of the earth. What is the mother dreaming right now? What is my dream and her dream? So you can come back out very inspired with the dreams of the land. Good thing to do right now that since we're in a lot of earth changes, you know, it's a good thing to go back to some of these places and really feel the changes that are taking place, the way these old sites are awakening. They're very active right now. All my friends that are dowsers are saying, oh, you know, where there was a ley line that was 12 feet wide, now it's 33 feet wide.
Wow.
So something's happening. The old woman of the world and the young woman of the world, they're dancing.
Well, the women of the world seem to be dancing and creating quite a stir for us men folk because, quite honestly, I think it's absolutely true that men need to relearn how to behave, among other things. Not only treating women right, but treating themselves right. I think that, and again, this isn't a criticism per se, it's an observation that, you know, this is part of the transition that we're in.
It's so true. It's so true. And you know, now that I'm writing Kings and Heroes, I realize that it's much easier for me to get in touch with the feminine archetypes than it is for me to work with the masculine, although they're now coming, but that original resistance to them.
Yeah.
But in the Celtic tradition, a true man, a true leader, a true king has to be granted that position through the feminine. So your wife would be the one, in your case, your wife would be the one who would get in touch, would dream with the Caillach and go, yes, he's worthy to be my king. And I think it's great because that way there are checks and balances. That way the wonderful wisdom and strength of the masculine is available to really flow. And the creative spark of the feminine is able to dance. And I think we're really meant to work together. And again, that's a lovely part of the Celtic tradition. It wasn't about one being on top. It was really about how do we dance together. And then there were celebrations in this, you know, springtime celebrations at the autumn equinox, at the spring equinox and the autumn equinox and Beltane, Samhain, where the male men and female got together and really enjoyed this dance. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you that the frustration I have with our society is especially the portrayal of the partnership relationship, male, female, or same sex, doesn't matter, where it's a competition to see who can get the upper hand, who can win, so to speak. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, you guys, you just chose to come together, to be together, to share time and do stuff. You know, I've never seen any individuals on a team fighting amongst themselves to try to be the best on a team where the team didn't, where the team won. Or if they did, they were pretty darn lucky. It's like, wait a minute, you're supposed to work together. You're supposed to be in this together and so forth. And so it's the portrayal, the stereotypes that keep coming out instead of reinforcing that bond that, you know, whether you're married or not, if you're living together, if you have a committed relationship, whatever the case might be, you know, I mean, even my boss and I, and he and I are kind of the team here that keep things moving. You know, he doesn't lord his managership over me. And nor do I lord my technical skills over him. You know, it's like we want to work together for the best of the station. And I think that's one of the frustrations I find in our society today. I have a poem here I want to share with our listeners from your book. You'll know, excuse me, you'll know which one it is as I read it here. I whisper to you in the space between stars. My thoughts hold you until the time of your awakening. Into the world of form, fortunate one, may you understand that your life is blessed. May you open your heart and receive what life is offering you. That is a neat little poem. I like that. From, and I don't even, if I'm not sure I'm going to get the queen's name right. Is it Dana? Goddess blessing?
Danu is the mother goddess of one of the first mother goddesses of Ireland. She's known as the mother of the Tuatha De Dunan, who were the tall, magical people of Ireland, the fairy folk. They're now known as the fairy folk.
Mm.
Yeah, and she's the guide. She's the guide through the book. And, you know, it's interesting what you know, we're talking about masculine roles and so forth. And I think one of the reasons, I think Joseph Campbell is the one that said that the hero's journey, the Arthurian legend and the hero's journey is the most, well, I think the story that we know the best in Western civilization. Everybody knows the story. They know it even better than biblical stories. So, and you know, and why is it that we know the hero's quest? And if you think for a minute, even like Kennedy loved the idea of Camelot. And I think this idea of unity and coming together at a round table is very much part of our psyche and an important part of our psyche. And the round table is etched into the landscape in Somerset. And then it's Camelot. There are a couple different places. Camelot was meant to be maybe Cadbury Castle. But you know, the idea of 150 knights sitting together and understanding that, you know, Lancelot might hold this particular piece. He might shine in this particular way, but Kai might shine in another way. Arthur shines in another way. And together they create one whole. I mean, they even have had difficulty fighting amongst themselves. But it's also the magical women, the women that hold the space, the 150 knights together, that are very important. And if you think a round table is a circle, it's feminine. It's on the cover of the book. There's a circle.
I see that, yeah.
Right? With the birds flying.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the things that I love about Arthurian legend and the Grail legend is that people know that in order to have a unified consciousness, you have to be in touch with, yes, the masculine strength, the courage to have what it takes, the intelligence, the rationality, all the things that are wonderful about the masculine. But you also have to be in touch with the creative spark of the feminine, the intuition, and the things that maybe aren't given enough credit in our culture. But hey, life is really important. The earth is really important. Mm-hmm. Our bodies are important, right? And the way that we love each other and connect and all these things are very important. And in this book, after the story of Danu, who's the guide through all the tales, we meet Emer, and Emer is known as one of the great beauties of Ireland. And Cuchulainn, now Cuchulainn is a famous Irish hero. He's like the Achilles of the Irish lands. And he falls in love with Emer, and she's a great beauty. She's very much like Bridget, very similar energies. And she says to him, if you want to marry me, you have to become a hero. You can't just come and think you're going to sweep me off my feet. It doesn't work like that. You have to prove to me that you have what it takes. And so he speaks to the king and he speaks to some other people, and he realizes that the only way that he's going to find the hero within himself is that he has to go. Your wife would like this. He has to go to the Isle of Skye in Scotland. So he has to row over there, and he comes to this place, and he has to jump across this huge ravine, this 22 feet wide, and underneath are all these skulls, but he has to jump. And then when he does land, there she is. She's waiting for him, and she's got black hair that flies in the breeze, and she's got a dagger, and she's hardly has any clothes on, and she's looking at him, and she's reading his future. Is this a king? Is this a loser? Who is he? And so she decides that he's a hero, and so she takes off running. And then what happens in his initiations with her is that he realizes his magic. He learns how to cast glamours. He learns about his intuitive skills, his clairaudience, clairvoyance, clairsentience. And so when he comes back, not only does he have these amazing, is he an amazing man, just in of himself as a great, he's like a football player. He's just a huge man. But he has this magic that he's brought back from the other lands because the goddess of sovereignty has kissed him and made it so. So at this point, now that he has all of his pieces, his entire grail is part of who he is, now he can go back to Emer and Emer will accept him.
Beautiful story. You are extremely passionate about this. I mean, that comes through. There's no question. Why does any of this stuff matter? It's all just folklore and hocus pocus and smoke and stuff. And it has nothing, and someone might say, nothing to do with the real world and business and government and so forth and so on. Talk to us.
I would say it has everything to do with that. Everything. And in the very beginning, I wouldn't have said that. In the very beginning, I went questing because I was top of my game. I was well educated. I had everything I needed. I had a great life, and I was empty. I just felt empty. I was like, why does it matter? Why does it matter that I'm here? And one day I'm walking along the road, and it's just a dirt road, and it's just this tree, and it's just dead. Everything's dead. And then something started to change. And it really started to change when I was in this place called Glastonbury in Somerset. And I looked into a well. It was like looking into this well you were talking about with Bridget. I'm looking into the well, and I had this feeling of presence that came to me. It was an amazing feeling of presence. And it came to me, and I realized, I'm actually engaging with the presence of the well, something that's very, it's very alive. It's part of the land, and it's part of me. And there's another world that somehow I've not been aware of. I haven't been tapped into this thing. So I became very curious about it. And part of it was for my own healing process. And it was, oh my goodness, the wondrous child wakes up in you and you become so curious, and there are all these places to go to and all these stone circles to find. And then you realize that these stories, like the stories of King Arthur and the Round Table, these stories are part of every single well, maybe not every single, but many great people know these legends. And these are the reason, this is one of the reasons, like Kennedy, for instance, back to Kennedy, he loved Camelot. And so he wanted a great America. And he was fed by these Arthurian legends. And I think, the bards, there's a real reason to have a bard around. And it's because if you know the stories of your people, and there are many people all over the planet, and there are many stories all over the planet. But if you know the stories of your own lineage, at some point, the stories become part of you. They live in you, and they feed you. And then when you encounter difficulties in your life, my children will say this too, when you encounter difficulties in your life, you go, oh, well, this is what Cuchulainn did when he met Skye. He knew how to behave. He knew this is what he did next, or this is what. So you have a reference point. And so I would say now more than ever, these stories are important because we're at a precipice. We're at a point where things are changing rapidly. And if you can stay, say, 60% in your in-world, and you know the guardians and the different beings that are with you and love you and support you and guide you, you don't have to be that worried about the 40% being out in the world. But you're able to make a much better contribution. You're not functioning in a way that's fake. You're functioning in a way that's very authentic. Your whole lineage, hundreds of grandmothers and grandfathers behind you, want this world to be a beautiful place. They want us to get through the challenges that are going on right now. And if we really listen to them and then we engage, like you and I are right now, and we engage with each other, then all of a sudden, there are all these creative possibilities and ideas that come forward. And yes, we could create a beautiful new golden age, a new Camelot, a new round table.
Mm-hmm. Two things come to mind. One of them is that when we did that series on mythology back in 2014, I just took the position of host, co-host, and allowing the universe to ask the questions as I always do, and I'm just along for the ride, and felt that when it was over that I was darn close to having a PhD because of the conversation with the people. We had Pulitzer Prize winners who were part of the program talking about mythology and sports in particular. The other thing that I found interesting, too, as you were talking, that was in terms of the importance. There was an episode of Star Trek Next Generation, and it was actually a very beautiful story that was told through the episode. And the best way I can describe it, the main myth, the phrase that kept coming out was, Jalad at Tanagra, sails unfurled, arms open wide. And it took the whole episode, for Picard to begin to understand and then do a comparison to that story he was being told by this alien, if you will, okay, and comparing that to the story of Gilgamesh, which I have no clue what the story is, but he did, and he was able to put those two stories together. And then they were able to communicate, even if it was rudimentarily, to go up against the creature that was actually on the planet. There was actually a predator, a protagonist, if you will. And I thought, wow. I mean, he could have just said, I'm going to go off on my own because I can't understand you. It takes a lot of not just courage, but it takes a great deal of, I'm going to say, imagination, if you will, to begin to understand these stories, because most of what you have spoken about is foreign to me, yet I understand the gist of these stories. And I have to say that I feel as though, when I look back on my education, it is so deficient, because I'm thinking world history, we should have spent a month talking about the Chinese culture over 5,000 years. A lot to cover in a month, granted. But then also maybe Indian culture. I'm talking about India, the country. The Middle East, and not necessarily the religions per se, although they're rather impactful in the way in which they interact. Europe, East and Western Europe. The British Isles, including Ireland. The United States prior to Christopher Columbus. It's as if somebody was trying to hide something. And I remember when we were celebrating the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus sailing the ocean blue in 1492. I knew the story from school, but at the time we were celebrating this and I was working for another station, I heard three different versions of the story. One made him out to be a saint. Another made him out to be devil incarnate, and then a third was somewhere in the middle.
Right. I think he was a slave trader, from what I've gathered.
Yeah. And the other thing too, I find funny too, sad, is when I hear about people who are wanting to basically return this country back to whatever they think its roots are supposed to be. And I'm sitting here, I hate to say this, but your forefathers predominantly are the ones that brought the slaves over here in the first place, the very people you seem to hate. So really, this is on you. You know, I mean, that's just just my observation, you know, but it's like, you know, they're not to blame. They didn't want to come here in chains. And then the Irish are the same way. The Chinese were treated the same way. Different cultures that have come that were either brought here or came here were treated the same way. If you weren't of the right lineage, then you're going to work on the railroad. You're going to work in the mines. You're going to work in the fields, et cetera, et cetera.
Maybe for some of these people, too, though, they came over as indentured servants, which includes a lot of Scots-Irish. You know, what might have kept them going were their stories. But what I it was interesting when I met John Patrick and I said, you know, I've done years and years of research to go back and find these ancient Irish goddesses and heroines of the Celtic lands that the Irish are very interested in because they're having a kind of a golden age renaissance going on over there with the stories of their land. They love them and they're bringing them back. But you know, the people weren't interested initially. When they left Ireland, I think that was so painful. You know, the fact that they had to leave this Emerald Isle and they severed themselves from a lot of the tales. And then I think there were forces that meant for that to happen too. I don't know exactly who these people are, and I'm not going to speculate.
No, that's okay.
But if you lose your inner world, if you lose your connection to your inner world, if you lose your connection to your stories and your people, then you really are a slave. And I don't care if you have chains on or not, you're living in a world that's dead.
Yeah.
And when you go back, you really walk. I mean, I was definitely following my ancestry. And if you go back and find these people, some are bound in chains and some aren't. But what happens is you trace yourself back to your origin of light if you take it far enough. And at that point, you know, when your imaginal world opens up, people go, oh, it's make-believe. All of this is, the entire thing, we're in a dream right now. Mm-hmm. We're dreaming this conversation. The imagination is everything. And so if you can get back in touch with this creative genius that's helping this world blossom and wake up and work with that energy, oh my goodness, you know, the possibilities are limitless.
They really are. They really are. We are talking with Anne Kate Sullivan, and we are talking about the legends of the Grail as stories of Celtic goddesses as well as heroines of Avalon and other tales. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay where you are.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Hey, welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, along with my very special guest, Anne Kate Sullivan, and we're talking about the work that she's doing and has been doing for quite some time. She is, or has, I should say, she has an MA, an MFA, a PhD, an LBQ, a GQW. I don't know what the others are. But anyway, she's also an award winner as well as a best-selling author. She holds, as I mentioned, a master's degree in spiritual psychology from USM and a master's and doctorate in literature from Columbia University and King's College, in London. Very nice. Well-traveled. There's no question about it. I love doing these programs, and I love being a part of radio stations over the years, nearly 40, where the guests that come in, the people that come in talking about the things they talk about, I feel like I've got PhDs in multiple subjects. I'm basically getting my PhD from you via osmosis, okay? I just don't get the paperwork. And I don't have to spend hours in the library or in the classroom. But I learned so much, and my library of books is growing and growing and growing, and I will have to take 55 years off just to read them all. It's just astounding. Now, is the Celtic tradition, the Celtic legend at large, part of not only Ireland, but also all of the British Isles.
Yes, British Isles and also France. And if you go back far enough, it also includes, especially Normandy.
Okay.
So if you include, at one point, it would have been most of Europe. But the woman who made these stories famous, and the reason we know the stories of the Grail, is actually Eleanor of Aquitaine, who was my, according to Ancestry.com, was my 25th grandmother. But she was she was a French and an English queen, and the most powerful woman of her age, rode on the Crusades and loved the stories of the Grail so much, she had the Welsh bards come and tell them in her courts. And that's why they're so well known. That's why the kings know these stories. The kings and leaders, heroes, know these stories so well. Is actually, we have to take our hat off to Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Well, and I take my hat off to you. I'm in the presence of royalty, my liege.
not all parts, but you know, there's always good to have a little blue blood in there.
It ain't bad. It doesn't hurt.
And my husband says he has green blood because he's Irish. Ah. 99%.
Let me ask you, does he have an accent?
He does, but he's more of a New York accent.
No, okay. Not an Irish accent.
Not an Irish accent.
And that's too bad for him. I don't know what his problem is. He's going to have to work on it a little bit. You know what I mean? Anyway.
So one thing that I think so important, you know, because I know you're a storyteller, you love stories and you want to know why these Celtic ones are important. And the thing is, if any time that I'm talking, just about anybody, any kid, child definitely gets it. But the indigenous people here in Santa Ynez, I know a Chumash leader here, and he loves hearing the tales of the Celtic people, and he tells me the tales of his people. And I also had meetings with Mayan priests, and they would say, oh, please tell these tales to people. They're so important. And then they tell me their tales, because people know. They know the stories of the grandmothers and the grandfathers. They know the stories of the magician and the trickster. They appear in all traditions, anywhere, in the Norse and Afro-American and Chinese, everywhere. So what we're dealing with, if we go big enough, we're dealing with archetypal beings. And if we think of like the old woman of the world, the Kaliach, these stories have been told about her for 10,000 years. And we're old, we get to get, maybe if we're lucky, 90 years here. So we start to work with these huge energies. And whichever one we're identified with the most, it's curious, because if you find one that you really identify with, that's probably going to be the story of your life. That's probably the way you're going to live things out. So it's good to know which ones you love the most or which ones repel you the most.
Yeah.
Because then you'll probably know what archetype you're identified with and the way that you're living out your future. And do you want to? Is that the archetype you want to be identified with?
And as far as longevity is concerned, 90 years? No. I had a grandmother back in 1995 at a reunion who was 95 at the time. Thereabouts. Right. And I was doing interviews with her and other relatives to get some stories. And I was just kind of joking around saying, yeah, I'm going to outlive her. And every reunion thereafter, I would say the same thing, but add to it. But she's making it really hard. And it's not that I want my great-grandmother to die. It's just that if I'm going to outlive her, she's got to stop somewhere so that I can catch up. She died at 100.
I love it. I love it. And well, she, now I want to know something. I've heard this many times that if the people that live to be centenarians, the ones that live to be 100 years old, are usually the ones that really love stories and they like to sit on the porch and rock and they like to talk to people and they like food and they like connection. Was she one of those people?
She actually was. Although I found it so fascinating when I was interviewing her, the other relatives were sitting around, my aunts and uncles. And when she would tell part of a story, they would. So, well, actually, what happened was, you know, they would throw in whatever version they had heard. And I'm thinking, okay, fine. It's funny, too, because I recorded those interviews on a cassette and somehow the cassette disappeared for a while. And again, this was back in 95. So I didn't move to Santa Barbara until 2006, over a decade later. And I could not find that tape anywhere. And then one day, about 8 years ago, it just turned up and I stopped everything and I recorded that onto the computer. I didn't want to lose it. Made some CDs, sent them to my parents because they wanted copies and so forth. But it is interesting to hear the stories and again, to have those experiences. As a matter of fact, I remember hearing This has to do with architecture more than anything else. When they changed the size of the front porch of a home, it changed the way we did things. We wouldn't sit out on the porch in the evenings in a rocking chair and maybe tell stories and say hi to the neighbors as they walked by and so forth. We don't have porches like that anymore. And it's very interesting how those seem like real subtle things. They're like non-consequential things. But you know what? That makes a big difference when you're talking about community. And these stories, Celtic stories, they're talking about community too, aren't they?
You really are. There's one thing I really love when you go to the rambling houses and you have little kids and that are dancing. They're just dancing because they love the stories and maybe they know some Gaelic words and they're going to sing them. And then you have really old guy and maybe he can still play the fiddle a little bit and he's playing the fiddle. And then you have the young married couple and they're dancing together and they're in their bliss and their harmony. And everyone's functioning as a really loving community. I think it's really important for every person on this planet to feel included. And the old people, the old ones, they know wonderful tales. They've been through so much, and we tend to skip past. And it's really important to listen to our elders, the wise ones, to listen, to go in search of the Kaliak. That's the last story in Legends of the Grail, that Bridget, the goddess Bridget, the young woman goes in search of the old woman of the world, and everyone's terrified. Oh, don't go find her. You don't want to find her. She's death. She's terrible. She's destruction. But Bridget says, no, I'm not whole. If I don't go find the old woman of the world, I don't really know who I am. I don't know everything that's going to happen. I don't know my wholeness. I don't know what it is going to be. So she has to go. And then I won't tell you the tale. You have to go read the story. But she keeps finding her in ways that she's not expecting, very surprising ways. But she comes back a different woman. Yeah.
The book, the companion book, if you will, or other work here is Heroines of Avalon and Other Tales. First of all, I'm not going to ask you where. I'm going to ask you what. What is Avalon?
Ah, Avalon. So did you ever, if you've ever been to Britain, have you ever taken an adventure into the British Isles?
Only through Heathrow.
Heathrow, okay.
To Ireland and back again.
Okay. So if you're in right outside of London at Heathrow and you travel, you get a car and you travel to the southwestern part of England, you come to a place called Somerset. And that's really the home of a lot of the Arthurian legend. And there's actually, you can fly in a plane. There's something known as the Glastonbury Zodiac. So you can fly over and you can see how a zodiac is built into the land. And if you go to the Chalice Well, you're actually standing on the dove, the Aquarian dove. So it's a very magical place, and people, it was known for, I guess it's still known, but especially when Christianity was at its height during Eleanor's age, it was known as the British Jerusalem, and it was supposed to be the place of the first church. And so there are all kinds of stories. So if you go there, the whole place is just myth and legend. It's just everyone that loves myth and legend that goes there, you know. So, and now they actually now have a goddess temple, where people who are interested in goddess worship or knowing more about goddesses, you can go and you can, it's a very legitimate place where you can go and become a high priestess of Avalon. So answering what Avalon is, so there's a place called Glastonbury, and what's very famous there is there's a hill called the Tor. And in the old tales, in Arthurian legend, you could author, if you wanted to find out who you were, you had to ride down to meet the dragon. You had to ride into the underworld. And so a noon would open up and you would ride to this other world. And so when the high priestesses were training, and when, you know, if a hero maybe was ready, and if you maybe got a chance to taste this apple of immortality, you could sail off in the Irish tradition to Tiernanog, land under the wave, and in the British tradition, you sail off to Avalon. So it's the Isle of the Golden Apples. And many people, mystics and poets, will sit on the tour and they say, ah, yes, you know, I did my meditation and I was able to travel to Avalon. And so it's Avalon. It's a wonderful idea that, yes, there is this mystical enchanted place, and it's not that close. It's not that far away. It's not close and it's not far away. It's this parallel dimension, you know, that we can tap into. in Santa Barbara as easily as England.
Absolutely. I have to say that it was really exciting to be able to take a boat out to the Aran Islands when we were there in 2004. Haven't taken a boat out. Well, I take that back. We've actually taken a couple of boats out to the Channel Islands, but never got off and onto the islands, which we want to do. Actually traveled down to Los Angeles to take a boat out to the Catalina Island, where they actually have a port named Avalon, one side of the island.
Yes, and probably for that reason, too, because it was it's the mystical land. You know, it's the land of hope, basically.
Yeah. It's the opposite side. It's not facing land. It's facing the ocean.
Right. So I'm trying to think. So traditionally, and there's a place here, too, in at Gaviota Point, where I believe the Chumash would send their warriors and heroes and their loved ones after they had died. They would send them out into the west. So that in the Celtic tradition also, you send the kings and heroes, your warriors, your queens, as the sun sets to the west so that they travel safely to the other worlds. You know, and they all have different names. But.
Yeah, that's interesting because you make me think about a tradition. It's predominantly an Irish tradition, but not exclusively. I haven't experienced it yet, but I'm familiar with it, and that is the wake. Now, I did something like that for one of our cats, who, by the way, was named Merlin.
I love it.
And he actually lived up to the name in many cases because there were times, and these cats are indoor cats. We live up on the 154 Old San Marcos Pass at the summit, right at the top. And these cats are indoor cats. They do not go outside. But there would be times when my wife would say, where's so-and-so? Where's this cat? Where's that cat? I said, well, I don't know. And so we would start looking throughout the house. Now, this is a two-room cottage. This is a two-room. Where's the cat going to go? All right. We can't find him. Can't find him. We went in this room. They weren't there. We went in that room. They weren't there. We kept going to the kitchen, the living room, the porch, and so on and so forth. And then all of the sudden, he would just show up. Now, his last magic trick, if you want to call it that, was right around his passing. And, of course, my wife was very, very broken up over the process. And at one point, with her stethoscope, she works in cardiology and Sansum, and with her stethoscope, she checked to see if his heart was beating, and it had stopped. And she lost it. And he came back.
Aww.
And he stayed for, I think, she told me he stayed for another hour or two, and then he finally passed for the last time. And I said, I want you to know that was his last magic trick. Mm-hmm. He came back for you. So anyway, what I did after his passing, and I knew that I was going to do this, I just had this feeling. We had had this box that we had would allow him to rest, and we coated it with a blanket and so forth. So what I did was for the other five cats, at that time there were six. The other six cats, what I did was I put him in that box. It was a shallow box with the towel underneath him, you know. I laid him in state on the dining room table so that the cats and even our dog could come and pay their respects. And we left him there for one day, and then we laid him to rest. One of the things that I've learned, and maybe the wake is part of this, is that I want all of the animals to be around when one of them passes. My beloved Makushla passed away last October. We had to let her go. Mm-hmm. And one of my cats, if you will, my wife got him for me. His name is Ryan. Mm-hmm. As we're loving her to the end, he comes over and lays down next to her.
Yes.
And then one of the other cats, it is to me, that to me is the same kind of thing in the animal kingdom that the Irish do when it comes to wakes.
Exactly. Yes. I actually just I've been a walker between the worlds for a long time, but when it's your own parents, it really hits home. And, my father crossed last March, and I was with him for the last week. And when I came in, he said, Will you hold my hand? Will you lay with me and hold my hand so that we can walk to the other side together? I want to know where I'm going. So, and we had done this with animals. We had done this because we lived on farms, and we had helped. We had been singing to the horses and the cats and the dogs when they cross. And I think they, what they do is they teach us how to go nobly into the mystery. And so I laid with my father, and we crossed, we dreamt together. He was still very conscious, and he found his friend, Jim, who had been a minister and a very good friend of his. And he said, "Oh, no, I know I'm with Jim. It's okay. Everything's okay." And then he came back, and he was very cheerful, and he told everyone goodbye. And he said, at one point when all the people were gone, he said, "Well, how's this going to work?" And I said, "Well, Dad, you know, if you're a king, the sun will set. And when the sun sets, then you're going to walk into the setting sun, and you'll be fine. You'll be with Jim." And that's exactly what he did. It was very beautiful. He was very conscious. He was very clear. He wasn't frightened. No drugs. And he just walked to the other side. And I thought, oh, my gosh, he just really taught me how to die consciously. And that's one thing I love about the Irish wakes and the Irish traditions. We sort of had a wake for him. We did have a wake, I suppose, in a sort of Virginia version of a wake. But I love the fact that people will come and they'll sing and they'll tell stories and poems, and it's a celebration of life. Bridget, the goddess Bridget, or the saint, also brought in the tradition of keening, which is when you cry. There are women that come and they cry. They bring in the sorrow also. They cry and they cry and they cry. And but what a great way to celebrate life. And we also did what traditionally you do is you keep the body for 3 days to make sure that the soul goes where it needs to go. So someone's always with the soul, because they say that the person comes in, they touch their body again, because they're leaving this form that they've known, this clay. The clay is going to return to the earth, but they're going to the spirit world. So they're going to touch in, but it's new. The spirit world's new because they haven't been there for a while. So they'll touch into the spirit world, and then they come back to their body. And if you're there in the room, you can feel it. And if you can keep singing, we were able, my sisters, my mother, my aunts, and so forth, we were able to keep singing over his body and or be with him or sit silently for 3 days until you could feel when he had actually made his departure.
Wow. That's exciting. It really is.
Yes.
It's one of the subjects that I love talking about on this program in particular, the whole aspect of transitioning, as I like to call it, because it is, there is such a mystery about it, and it's more a mystery because we don't talk about it.
Right.
We don't discuss it. I loved a documentary I saw several years ago on death. This crew would travel the world experiencing the different kinds of death. And there was one tribe, I think it was in Africa, either that or South America. In any event, they were down there and this person had passed. And of course, there they were preparing the body and so on and so forth. And then the head of the community said, "And you and your team are going to have to leave now. We'll let you know when you can come back." I said, "Well, why do we have to leave?" "Because for the next 24 hours, we are going to be going through one of those stages of grieving that we cannot control, and we won't. And that's the anger portion. And you and your crew might get hurt." And so they left. Mm-hmm. They didn't film. And I thought, wow, that's right. Pretty courteous. But also, that's pretty... astute that, oh, we have to go through these stages as a community, you know, because this person was a part of our community. And I remember that stage for me when my dear friend Dave passed away on the 10th of October of 2003. And it was the Saturday after his passing, and we were laying there in bed. And I just sat up after, and I just said, why the hell did you, you know, I mean, I went off. And afterwards, I'm going, where the heck did that come from? You know, you know, it shocked me, and that was me doing it.
Right.
We don't, you know, there are lots of stories. And yes, it is true that nobody really knows what's on the other side, or even if there is another side. I mean, if it's lights out, how are you going to know?
Right, exactly.
And how are you going to tell anybody if there is, you know, an afterlife, We have all of these beautiful stories and theories and so forth. And, you know, I've shared with people that my theory is, from a logical standpoint, it doesn't make any sense that there isn't anything after this, because something inside of me says my life has meaning. Because if I didn't have that, I could go out and rape and pillage and plunder and it wouldn't matter, because my life wouldn't have meaning. But it does. Ergo, I say, that makes no sense that there's nothing after this, so I choose to believe that there's something after this.
We had a lovely confirmation after my father died. So his friend Jim was a minister, and his wife was much younger than he was. And she has always said to us that she has kept a conscious relationship with him while he's on the other side, and that he's continued to be a psychopomp or someone who helps people cross. And so I would imagine that, of course, he'd act as a guide. He was that in this life. And so she didn't know that my father was ill or dying. And after his crossing, she called on the phone and she said, you know, I was having a meditation. I was talking to Jim, and she said that that Bill is over here with him now. Did he cross over?
Wow.
Right. Wow. And it was a love. Because I sort of said, oh, yes, that's what happened. And then I thought, my mother needs to hear this. My mother needs to hear that he's okay, that I'm not making something up to make her feel better. So I handed her the phone, and she, you know, her eyes filled up with tears. And and then the doctor, it was funny, our family doctor was there, and he went, that means there's an afterlife.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't think this is the only dream there is. I mean, we're talking about Star Wars and spacecrafts, and, you know, Merlin, the name Merlin, it comes from the Mer, the people of the sea, and they were supposed to be the stars that fell into the ocean at the beginning of time that held the blueprints that so we could remember how to grow in terms of consciousness and awaken to master beings. Wow. That's the earliest Merlin story. Merlin's very, very ancient. He's a very wonderful archetypal character and being, and very accessible for people who are ready to open up to the enchanted worlds.
We had a lovebird named Merlin, and my wife at the time had four Siberian Huskies, a dog team. And we had these French doors that you had to make sure were latched properly. Otherwise, the dogs, they were outside dogs in the backyard, fenced in and so forth, secure and protected. But you had to make sure the French doors were latched properly. Otherwise, they could break through them, because they were pretty strong dogs, and tear up the house. So we put the dogs in the back and we latched the doors, and we said, we'll see you later on, Merlin, the lovebird that was in the cage. We left, and when we came home, the house was a mess. The French doors were wide open. The bird cage was wide open. There were feathers here and there, a feather or two here and there, and we thought that one of the dogs had gotten Merlin. But about 4 months later, we were having dinner, Thanksgiving dinner, outside on our patio, and my wife looked up at one of the trees, and there he was. We also found out, too, that apparently in different communities, there are flocks of lovebirds that hang out together and fly around the city.
Oh.
And so, you know, I mean, I'm with you on that. I was like, okay, I'm not sure if I want to name every other animal that we get Merlin, because it can be beautiful and frustrating all at the same time.
Exactly. Well, Merlin's such the shapeshifter, because he's another character. He's great because he appears in so many stories and in every generation. You could author a lot too, but Merlin's always showing up. Yeah. And yeah, in Harry Winds of Avalon, he appears there too as the he has a lover named Nimue. And Nimue, in Harry Winds of Avalon, it's interesting because I went back looking for the names of women, because in this book I have the only woman, the first person to achieve the Holy Grail, and they, in Arthurian legend, and they never give her a name. They say they call her Percival's sister. So I found out her name is Dendrane or Dendrana. And I was so happy to be able to track these people down and find them and how they were able to accomplish these things. What Dendrana does is she opens the gateway to Seros, or heaven. so for the rest of the nights, the round table, so they can follow. There are also these magical characters, because you can't have Arthurian legend without Merlin. I mean, it's just boring, all these knights around, right? And with Merlin, you have these nine ladies of the lake, and they're very mysterious. And talk about walkers between worlds. So they reside in Avalon, the other world. So when you see, an Excalibur, you see the sword coming up through the lake. This is probably Argante giving us the sword of truth, the sword of power, because they know that if society is going to survive, if author is going to be reborn through us, that we have to find the four hallows. We have to find, in the first one in this series is the Grail. We have to find our inner mystery, our feminine nature, our clairvoyance, clairaudience, clairsentience, and not be afraid that of these other things that are outside of our, what we think of our box, they're outside of our box.
Yeah.
But our box has become too tight. The box can become way too small, and we have to bust out, like Merlin, your bird. He has to enjoy the whole world,
Well, let me ask you something about mythology and these Celtic stories in particular. Now, I would not think that anybody would be so malicious as to attempt to distort the stories, because they probably think, they're unimportant, as opposed to the events that are happening around us in this day and age. They want to manipulate the story. They want to twist it, turn it, spin it, as the phrase goes, so that only the parts they want revealed are revealed. I know that a lot of people feel that way about the Bible, for example, although I think that they made a huge mistake in the Gospels when they gave credit to Mary Magdalene for seeing Jesus as he was following his resurrection as the Christ, when the men didn't. And I'm thinking, it shouldn't have been Peter as head of the church. It should have been Mary Magdalene. But that's another story for another time. What about the accuracy of the stories? And maybe it's not so much the accuracy per se, and I'm not sure exactly how to pose this question in terms of the stories that you share, that you've heard, that you impart to people, both verbally as well as through these books. Give me your impression.
Well, I love so in the early Celtic Church, the stories of Mary Magdalene. If you're in Glastonbury, the Magdalene was meant to be the head of the church. She came up through France, fleeing for her life. She came up with Joseph of Arimathea to Somerset, and his holy thorn is planted on a hill. It's, unfortunately, somebody just chopped it down, but for 2,000 years it was there. And so she was ushered in and was known for a long time as the Grail. And if you go to the Chalice Well, supposedly she carried something that was held inside the well. Other people say no, it was that Mary Magdalene herself was there with her child Sarah, who was really the Merovingian lineage, who was really the carrier of the vine of the divine light. And so what's interesting about the early Celtic Church is all these stories really blend. You get the old stories of Lu, the god of the sun, who's very much like the Christ, and you get Danu. Danu or Arinrud, who are very much like Mary. So they're the creator goddesses. So they blended really easily in that place. The people could understand those stories and archetypes and how they work together. So it was a wonderful melting pot. And eventually, of course, the Romans came in and they added their own myths and legends. And then after that, in about the 5th century, you get utter chaos. And, I think maybe the Catholic Church had something to do with it. I would suspect so. But Mary Magdalene's taken out, the Council of Nicaea. No, she's, if you believe that, you're heretic. So they take her stories out. And then you're left with what? You're left actually with the missing grail, the missing feminine. All the feminine starts to go underground. And a lot of these legends are about this. They take the stories of Cruwidden, who's a goddess of sovereignty, and they turn her into a witch, evil sorceress. And so a lot of the tales in the book, in the way that it's given traditionally, they look like sort of evil sorceresses. And then as you work with them, you go, oh no, these are actually very magical beings. So in the time of King Arthur, there was a man, a king by the name of, if you look at his name, it looks like A Man Gone, which is interesting. And A Man Gone and his soldiers went and raped all the Grail maidens. And they were the ones that would sit by the well, and you would come, and they would give you stories and bread, and they would help you find your magic, your way to Avalon, to the other world. And once this happened, the feminine energies, the ladies of the lake, the guardians of the well, all these magical, enchanted people, they disappeared. They were gone. And of course, what happens when you disregard the feminine in that way, and also you're also disregarding the masculine if you do that, what happens is you get a wasteland. And what happens? It's too cold. It's too hot. The wind's blowing. It's not safe. Everything, the land goes into despair. The people go into despair. The people are sick. They're depressed. Why? It's because they've forgotten who they really are. They've forgotten their own inner mystery. They've forgotten to honor the truth of who they are.
We're going to talk a little bit about that just before we wrap up the program. I want to thank you so much, Anne Kate Sullivan, for joining us here on the program and sharing these stories. I encourage people to investigate further. Go to your website, which is what? What is your website?
My website is, my name is a little unusual, so I think I was named after an Irish fairy named Anya. So it's A-Y-N, but we say Anne, AnneKateSullivan.com. And you can look at my events if you're interested in pilgrimages or you're interested in your own storyline, whatever tradition that is. I work with people. So you can do AnneKateSullivan.com, and then you can also find my books, Heroines of Avalon or Legends of the Grail, in town at Chaucer, say, and at Paradise Found, and most bookstores, and also on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so forth. So I hope you enjoy the tales. I hope your wondrous child awakens and that you begin a quest into this new time, this promise of the new time.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's so much more we could be talking about. I didn't have a chance, of course, to get into the whole current day issues regarding the feminine and so forth, especially in reference to the Me Too movement and era and so forth. But I remember what was shared with me just in passing by someone was that this was not about, not that's the movement specifically, but in terms of the feminine rising up, it wasn't a rising up, a revolution, we're taking over. It was a rising up, we need to balance. We need to balance. And, you know, because going the other extreme is not helpful either. And I'm hoping that the transition that we're going through in this particular period of time that we live, I'm hoping that we do achieve that balance one day. I also want to thank you so much for joining us. And, you know, I know you're there in the San Ynez Valley, but you know what? I'd like to have you in studio next time and we could continue this conversation. I love face-to-face interviews.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to it. Maybe when Kings and Heroes comes out, we can have a Grail quest together.
Let's do that. I would love to do that. And then I have three final questions for you before we wrap up our program. But a reminder to our listeners that, again, the titles of the books that I would encourage you to pick up a copy of and then some are Heroines of Avalon and Other Stories and Legends of the Grail, Stories of Celtic Goddesses, and Anne Kate's Sullivan has been my guest, PhD. Thank you very much. And now I have mine. And also, if you'd like to support this program, please go to our homepage or the missions page, read what we're all about. And if it resonates with you, we would love for you to support us financially. We'll take energetic support as well. Three final questions for you, Anne, and they are, who is Anne Kate Sullivan?
Oh, then that's the eternal question. Who am I? In the most mundane sense, so we can wrap our heads around it, I'm a folklorist, a mythologist, a storyteller. And I love sharing stories, and I love going on quests, and sometimes people work with me doing that too. But I would call myself a mythologist.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
What I really hope is that people find their wondrous child, that they wake up, that they find some stories that really serve them. And I see us holding hands and walking into a new age together, a new light, golden time.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
my life. I'm living my life purpose and mission. I knew as a child when my grandmother was stirring a pot on the stove and she was telling me the stories of the knights of Northumbria and the Scottish kings and queens and so forth, that I was going to go and I would find those tales and I would return with the tales for my people to keep their hearts light even during the darkest times.
Ann Kate Sullivan, again, thank you so much for joining us and giving us so much time here on the program. And I encourage our listeners to go to the podcast, because if you're listening to the radio broadcast, you're going to miss a lot. So go to the podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, and many other locations, as well as the homepage of RichardDugan.com. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time. Love, Talal.